Thank you, Mr. Man.
Anytime, Miss Man.
That was Mrs. Man.
Mrs. Man's in the back. Looking.
Okay, normally I would stand in front of the classroom, but...
Please stand.
The problem is if I stand, I can't see anything. Otherwise, I have to be here or here.
You want to put it?
I do have to see it.
You want to put the laptop
right over here? Oh, yeah.
That would be very nice.
No, just put it.
I'm so glad Asian churches are so tech savvy. Whoop. You're not supposed to see that yet. Okay, hi, everybody. Welcome to my seminar. Oh, such good students. Yay, everybody give yourselves a round of applause. Okay, so today, this is technically part one of a two-parter because Pastor David was like, you want to lead Sunday school tomorrow? I was like, okay. So there will be a follow-up tomorrow if you are here. But if you're not here, that's okay. Hopefully I will give you some interesting information as Pastor Zhao said yesterday, some special information that you can take home. Okay, so today we are talking about cultural identity, something that I've spent a long time studying. So the main questions that we're addressing are, how do our cultural identities affect, excuse me, there's a sidebar going in at the side of the classroom. Okay, so question number one, how do our cultural identities affect how we see our potential for missional living? This might not make 100% sense yet, but hopefully by the end, we will have a lively and rousing discussion about what that means. Number two, what is my cultural identity? What does it mean for me to have a cultural identity? Number three, more fundamental than the other two, what is culture? Because this is a very nebulous term, and it gets thrown around a lot in modern political discourse. But I don't think a lot of people have really sat down and considered what culture is or how to do it. And finally, what does God want me to do with this culture stuff? So this is, I think, a more broken down version of question one. What is culture? What does God want me to do with it now that he gave it to me? Not that I necessarily asked for it, but I have it anyway. So it's got to be there for a reason, right? Okay, so in order to understand all these questions and possibly formulate useful answers, we're going to start with small group discussion, my favorite educational tool. Okay, so I would like everybody to, it looks like groups of four or five will be most expedient. So in groups, I would like you to define the following phrases. Please record your answers on your phones in your notes app or something. I was gonna give you paper, but I forgot to give you paper. So I have three terms that I'd like you to look at. Number one is work culture. Number two is cultural expression. And number three is multicultural. So you don't have to know exactly what these mean. I would just like you to start discussing amongst yourselves what you think it means. And then after you have defined these phrases, I would like you to then discuss what these phrases tell us about the way culture works. So imagine that you don't have any preconceived notion of the word culture. If we only had to rely on these three phrases to infer what culture means, what would we conclude? And this is really what this is asking you. Is it physical? Is it imaginary? Is it based around the artifacts and materials that we collect in our lives? Or is it more practice-based? And can we practice it individually, or is it something that we have to practice collectively? Okay, so for the next couple of minutes, please get into your groups, say hello to each other, introduce yourselves if you haven't already introduced yourselves, and begin discussing these very important questions. Thank you. Me too. I use it a lot on Discord.
I recognize it as an
idea. You guys want to work with the old folks? Look at the work culture. Look at the work culture.
Yes, you can pick one of the phrases if you like. You don't have to do all of them.
Work culture.
Are you retired?
I guess just say that sometimes it's like how it looks.
Hello. Welcome. Please come into my lair.
Let me. Oh, on the thingy? Okay. Yeah, it's light enough. Hello. I guess I don't need the pointer then. I'll move over here.
That's hard because I feel like I haven't really like worked on
Okay, please take one more minute to wrap up your conversations. Angel, can you close the door?
I guess it's a
Okay, let's come back together in a large group and continue our discussion together. Would anybody like to volunteer some of the definitions that they came up with in their group? Okay, in the back, please.
How much do I share?
However much you want. I also heard that there were struggles in defining these terms, so if you would like to share your struggles as a group as well, that might be enlightening.
Can we start with the cultural expressions?
Sure. Cultural expression.
Meaning, we found that as festivals, celebrations, food, fashion, holidays, art, traditions, and we also saw that as perspective and values, that we express our culture through that in a kind of non-visible way.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm hearing is that cultural expression is about cultural production, so creating things, as well as practicing things or participating in collective behaviors, right? Okay, does anybody else have a different definition for cultural expression?
I think cultural expression is what other people see and see you and identify you of that particular culture. Sometimes maybe you are, might not even be aware of it, I think.
Interesting. So externally visible practice of culture, right? So people from your out-groups can also recognize this as a culturally marked practice. Instead of something that perhaps everybody in society does, it belongs to a certain group. So you say, ah, this practice belongs to or is practiced by people in this culture. Great. Anybody else? Okay, awesome. Other terms that we'd like to define?
We saw that as many facets of a single individual that a single individual can have. In terms of like one of the examples, Hannah was talking about how like there's the Chinese culture, there's also American culture, there's also youth culture, and then there's also work culture. Like that, a person can inhabit that. And then we also talked about America being a melting pot, and that when we have multiple cultures in the same place, that they can change and transform and grow.
Great. So we've got both the society and the individual as places where multiple cultures connect and can perhaps transform each other. Very interesting. Anybody else have a different take on multicultural?
I think, am I talking too much?
No, in this case, you would be my favorite student in class, so. Even if what you say is wrong, as long as you say something and don't sit there silently, professor loves you.
Multicultural, a lot of times, nowadays, churches want to be multicultural, but in fact, I think what very often what they're talking about is multi-ethnicity more than multicultural, because even in a single culture, I mean, in a single ethnic group, you can have multiple culture, but what a lot of churches now are focusing on multicultural when it's really they are looking at multi-ethnicity, people of different, you know, creed and races coming together.
Interesting. So would you say that CCC, like a majority Chinese church like CCC, is multicultural without being multi-ethnic?
Yes.
Yes. Please expand on your answer.
Well, there's many different generations.
Aha.
So just because everyone is Chinese doesn't mean that they all have the same cultural experiences. So
yes, what a sophisticated understanding of multi-generationality of culture. Amazing. Thank you. And we also see like people from different parts of China, right? So even though they're all maybe ethnically Han, some people may not be, but like people from Hong Kong and people from Shandong may be the same ethnicity, but are from different cultures, right? They speak different languages and they have some different cultural practices, but they share a lot of the same traits as well. Okay, cool, cool, cool. So I think that is a great explanation and discussion of the term multicultural. So work culture, if you would like. Or do you want somebody else to do it? I can make one of these people. Okay. One of you. Give me an answer. Be my favorite student. Okay.
I think we just talked about work culture as in being like somewhere that's very like professional.
Mm-hmm.
And like from our personal experiences, or at least from mine, it's hard to like cross the barrier between being like professional versus like a personal friendship.
Mm-hmm.
So like you can be as friendly as possible, but in like a work culture, there's always kind of like a maybe like an aspect of like competition or something.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of just limits people from like getting closer, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. So there are limits on the kind of intimate relationships you can practice. A lot of people are like, no workplace fraternization, so don't date people that you work with. And these are also cultural standards, right? But they vary from workplace to workplace, which is quite interesting, I think, as a microcosm of explaining how culture works. So these are, if you don't mind me picking on you, how did you learn that these were the standards? Who set those standards?
I feel like I don't really have much experience like in a work culture, mm-hmm. but from what I've seen at least, I feel like I kind of set them myself because I kind of like look mm-hmm. at the environment and then I'll see like, okay, this is the kind of vibe that like I'm getting from it, so I'm just gonna have to like play into it.
Vibes-based decisions. Yeah. Honestly, they're very important. Learning to read the room is something that we must learn as young adults or we will not survive. But yeah, like you learn because others lead by example, right? Because other people don't become friends with you, you don't reach out to new people and become friends with them necessarily. Unless you wanted to change your workplace culture. Okay, so what did you guys think all of these different terms taught you about what culture is or what culture isn't? Or did it just confuse you even more? You may use the questions on the screen as a prompt. Yes.
I feel like it's everything.
Everything?
That it is physical, it's like visible, obvious, it's also like imaginary, and we create it. We actively create it by having mm-hmm. and practicing that. It's individual because we have like different parts of our identity. Affected by multiple cultures, and it's also collective because we build that together.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You've struck at the crux of the problem that I wanted you to identify. Great job, everybody. Culture is a nebulous mess of basically everything that permeates our lives, right? So what we think, how we think it, what we do, how we do it, and how we perceive other people and what we do about them. Right. So I'm going to now go into a little bit of a scientific background on what the term culture means. But I'd like you to keep these definitions in mind as we go through the next couple of slides. Okay. So first of all, culture is not a static term. It hasn't always meant the same thing. Back in the 19th century, there was this term civilization, right? And civilization and race and culture were very heavily intertwined and often treated as the same thing. So civilization was seen as this progression from barbarism to enlightenment. And this kind of gives rise to this dichotomy of uncivilized versus civilized, right? So the thought was in all these proto-social sciences like anthropology that these different races are in different stages of development. And who do you think was at the forefront of development?
Whoever came up with the definition.
And I wonder who that was.
White people?
white people, Western Europeans to be exact. They were like, okay, so we have Shakespeare, we have Darwin, we have all of these great, amazing thinkers. We inherited philosophy from the best civilizations, which were the Greeks and Romans, and therefore we have arrived at the apex of civilization. And we are so close to enlightenment. But these African tribes, I don't know what they're up to, so they must not be civilized, right? So black would be lowest and white would be highest, right? So the presence of culture, aka art and cultural production, things that we would think of as material in terms of practice and like creation, those were deemed culture, and only those artifacts that were deemed good enough or beautiful by Western standards would be accepted as culture, right? So these barbarians don't have any culture, therefore they are less enlightened. So in the 19th century, this kind of began to change. So you can see Sir Edward Tyler's Primitive Culture quoted up there. Culture is that complex whole which includes knowledge, belief, art, law, morals, custom, and any other capabilities and habits acquired by man as a member of society. So when he's referring to society here, he is referring to this concept of civilization and culture's role in civilization, right? Culture as this thing that is only produced by civilized people. But then in the early 1900s, actually, this begins to change. So we see this definition set forth by Franz Boas. If you know anything about anthropology or linguistics, you know that this guy is like foundational to those social sciences and their modern practice. So it is a dynamic, which means changeable, set of inherited social behaviors and customs that create the structure of a society. So I think this more approaches our modern definition of what culture is, right? So Boas undertakes this work of disconnecting culture from the concept of civilization. He is using it in a specifically anti-racist way because he's arguing that all societies have culture and that civilizational progression doesn't necessarily all occur on the same timeline, nor does it all orient towards what Western Europeans value, right? So for example, he would say, like the Chinese, they have their own cultures and cultural productions and arts, and just because they are not valued by Western standards, that does not mean that these aren't things that have been passed down through generations and have their own structures and intricacies, right? Our last definition comes from Raymond Williams in the 1960s. So he took some time to think about how we as a society have taken this concept of culture and kind of reworked it, right? So this definition of culture also includes the way we are conscious of culture, which is a little bit meta, right? To be conscious of the thing that you are practicing in. So it is a description of a particular way of life, which expresses certain meanings not only in art and learning, but also in institutions and ordinary behavior. So it's not only, right, art and cultural production now, but acknowledging that the way that we practice and relate to each other is also socially inherited, right? Our parents and the people around us teach us how to behave. And this can vary from circumstance to circumstance, but the most important thing is that it is an inherited behavior. So all of these things are kind of in reaction to this idea of scientific racism. If you ever see like these old anthropology slides, most of us would be described as Mongoloids or Mongolians, even though very few of us actually are from Mongolia. The idea that certain races have certain inherent traits seems very unsophisticated to us today, but actually it was at kind of like the spearhead of science back then. It was kind of this interesting way of dividing people into groups to scientifically justify colonialism and imperialism, because this at the time was a point where the United States was expanding overseas, especially if you read The White Man's Burden by famed writer Rudyard Kipling. This is a justification of using our, and by our I mean Western civilization's resources and enlightenment and culture to uplift inferior cultures such as Filipinos and the barbaric Chinese that were so, you know, pagan and sort of filthy that needed to be taught how to behave properly and in a civilized way. So I want you to take away from this the idea of culture as an inherently anti-racist concept in the modern day, because it essentially de-essentializes the way that we practice from the people that we are, right? So it's not that we were born practicing things in a certain way, it's that we were taught things that we now value as proper or normal. So I want us to carry that concept into the next definitions that I'm going to produce from ethnic studies, which is a much, much younger discipline than social science. Okay, any questions so far? I know that was a lot. Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe questions at the end. Okay, so the view from ethnic studies, which is where I got my master's, ethnic studies comes out of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. It comes out of a lot of young people realizing that they had been so involved in assimilation and trying to erase their cultures that they actually participated in a lot of cultural and racial self-hatred, right? So it's a reaction to this perception that white supremacy is actively erasing and suppressing minority histories and cultures. So this forces people to assimilate against their will, and it creates this feeling of self-hatred based on cultural identity. So if you read a lot of early Asian American literature, what you're going to see is a lot of authors describing, you know, I'm second generation, I hate the way I look, I hate the way I behave, I hate the way my family behaves, because my norm is white society, and they don't behave in a way that makes me look good in white society that is accepted by this dominant force, right? And we are punished because of it. And therefore, I've learned to hate these things that create suffering in my community. So their response was, okay, we should actually uplift these cultural practices, we should preserve them, and we should normalize them. So ethnic studies is kind of this practice of critiquing and engaging in cultural practice that uplifts the let's say traditions and ways of thinking and living and socially organizing of racial minorities. It's a way to restore these severed connections to tradition and history. And most of all, it creates new pathways to community futures. So not only is it a way for us to reconcile with our past, creating and engaging with our cultural identity on its own terms also helps us envision new futures for ourselves that don't involve, you know, self-repression or participating in greater regimes of racism and colonialism. So this is kind of the approach that I'm taking today because of my background in ethnic studies. But we also, because this is a Christian seminar after all, want to think about the view from scripture. So can I get 4 volunteers to read, please, in Christian tradition? Yes, Clara, would you read the first verse for us?
There is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus.
Great. So this verse seems to be advocating for total equality in every aspect. So he's saying, Paul is saying, anyone can come to Christ regardless of their position in the social hierarchy of their society. That's really interesting. We'll come back to that. How about verse number 2?
After this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands. Revelation 7:9.
Great. So this seems to indicate that diversity, cultural diversity, racial diversity, and national diversity are going to be preserved through the renewal of the world that takes place in Revelations. If you went to IV during college, you may recognize this verse as one of kind of like the pole positions of IV when it comes to cultural diversity. And if you went to IV, I want you to explain some of this in your small groups. Okay, how about verse number four, actually verse number three. Somebody who loves reading. Charles!
To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but I am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. I do all this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings.
Interesting. So here we have an example of Paul saying that he is participating in the customs of a group in order to better communicate the gospel to that group. That's also really interesting. He's not advocating for the eradication of cultural difference, but rather preserving it as a technique to better communicate the gospel. That's so interesting. How about verse number four? Steph.
Let's see if I can read from this angle. Whoever regards one day as special does so to the Lord. Whoever eats meat does so to the Lord, for they give thanks to God. And whoever abstains does so to the Lord and gives thanks to God. For none of us lives for ourselves alone, and none of us dies for ourselves alone. If we live for the Lord. And if we die for the Lord. So whether we live or die, we belong to the Lord.
Okay, this fourth verse seems to be Paul discussing different Christian cultures. So not only did different cultural practices of Christianity exist in the early church, he's almost saying that not all Christians will or should practice Christianity in the exact same way. Not that they should have, you know, wild doctrinal beliefs and that those should be accepted, but say, like, we're not really gonna kick Seventh-day Adventists out of the club just because, you know, they think that you should worship on Saturday instead of Sunday. We might kick them out for other reasons, but not for that particular reason. So there are non-doctrinal differences that are cultural that we should accept inside the church, which are really, really interesting concepts. So Paul says all these things with a great amount of confidence in who he is. He's like, I am so confident in myself that I can actually go to other groups, practice the way they practice, and not lose my sense of self and identity. But also acknowledge that there actually is no spiritual difference between us, right? He's taking this cultural identity as a moment to connect with other people in order to create even greater spiritual connections, right? So I'd like us to take some of these ideas into the next small group discussion. Questions, comments, concerns? I haven't changed slides yet, no. Okay, I can come back to these verses if you want. So we're going to take a little bit of a detour in our small group discussion. So given this new information, define the term culture in your own words. And then according to this definition, what are some of the cultures that you belong to? So you should come up with a list together. So in terms of cultures, you can say, I belong to ABC culture. Or I belong to Wooten High School culture. Aww. Or University of Maryland culture. Or maybe I belong to American culture. Interesting. So maybe you could even give us a couple of characteristics of what that culture is. Okay, so hopefully 5 minutes will be enough. Please begin.
Okay. Hello, digital clip. This is exclusive content for you. There's an octopus on screen right now.
I think the easiest thing to define it as is like as the club grows bigger, the amount of like separation like internally like grows, I feel like. Because if you just think of it like the extreme case as in like two people are part of the club, like only two people, then that would be like the most close the club can be, because just two people, right? But when there's, you know, there's like 200 and like you're new, it's like really, really daunting. Unless you really like throw yourself out. But yeah, I remember I was talking to some people, I think one time in like small group discussion, like in like sometime like maybe 2 years ago, we were talking about like if being like a close like group is good for like a fellowship club, because I think some people were affecting saying like sometimes Ivy just feels like a big like friend group instead of like a fellowship like club or like a nation club. So we were kind of, so then that kind of like got me thinking, I was like, when is it bad or when is it good to like go towards being more of like a ministry or going towards more of being like a friend group? Because I think like versus like being comfortable with everyone can only help like everyone like grow in their faith, because they're comfortable to share with other people. That's obviously good, but yeah, that was kind of like a perspective that I was thinking.
Okay, please take one more minute to wrap up your conversations.
Yeah. 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 Yeah
How
do you celebrate New Year? Family celebrate New Year?
Yeah,
okay.
To people going to vote. But we do want someone to focus on one.
How do you celebrate your loved one's birthday, your girlfriend's birthday, or whatever's boyfriend's birthday?
Okay, let's return to our large group discussion. I heard some very interesting things being said in some of these groups. Okay, so what were your answers when you defined culture? And once you give me your definition, rate your satisfaction with your answer. Okay, laughers in the corner, you go first.
Yeah, say that. All right, so I wrote culture and then I left it blank.
Oh, so you didn't... You didn't answer the question, is what you did.
Because it was too hard to define.
Okay. You didn't agree with...
Oh, I wrote that down, too. Oh,
okay.
No, I didn't want to just, like, steal that guy's answer, so...
Okay. Okay, did anybody actually define culture?
I think culture, I think to me, is what identifies you and your group that makes you different than... Another group,
mm-hmm.
which is another culture.
Mm-hmm. But what would be the thing that's different from religion versus culture? Or is it the same thing?
I think maybe religion can be...
Religion is part of a culture.
Hmm.
I look at culture as much more broader.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it could be art, could be... fashion, someone's talking about,
mm-hmm.
but in our faith, part is one of them, one of the parts of the culture.
Mm-hmm. Yes, interesting.
We had the same thought.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, thank you. Katie?
I think for our definition, the difference between religion and culture is that religion can be practiced individually,
mm-hmm.
but culture has to be practiced corporately.
Hmm, interesting. So individuals can practice religion, but when they come together in larger religious communities of religious practice, I think is like one of the theological terms for it or whatever, then that becomes something more like what we identify as a religion. Interesting. So I'm not saying that we should avoid overlap with terms. I'm just trying to highlight that there is a lot of overlap with community practice, right? So culture is a part of all these things. It's a framework of analysis that we use to look at our communities and identify what makes us different or what makes us identifiable to each other, right, as members of that community. Great. Do people find these answers satisfying? Is there anything that you would want to change about this definition of culture? Here's the next slide to help you. If not, we'll move on to the next question. So let's think about what cultures Paul belonged to. Can anybody shout out some of the ones that he may have identified with in his day?
A Pharisee.
A Pharisee, oh. A particular culture of religious practice, right. A particular cultural practice of Judaism. Interesting. Which also means that he identified more broadly with Jewish culture. Anything else?
Roman.
So he exists as a Jew under Roman rule. So he is part of this greater Roman imperial culture that he's working inside of.
I guess his culture is Christian.
Yeah. He's also a Christian. So he is a Christian who has intimate ties to the Jewish community, who is existing in the larger Roman Empire, right? So he has all of these different embedded identities inside of his cultural identity. And how does this affect his ministry? What's his perspective on the role of culture in missions? I can rewind to that other slide if you want.
I mean, I think you said that, like, he believed that you should immerse yourself in other people's culture in order to spread your faith, so.
Oh, so you agree with what I said? Okay.
Basically, say culture takes a back seat, should take a back seat to what you believe.
Interesting.
Say that, like, sharing the gospel to Paul, that, like, well, the, when you communicate and when you share the gospel specifically, like, it's going to be contextualized into, like, something, and if you're not thinking about it, it's just going to be, like, your own default culture, but, like, it's everything that we, whenever we communicate, we are doing it in a particular context, and, like, I feel like Paul is just very aware that you need to be aware of the context that communicate.
That was a great chain of discussion. Does anybody else have anything to contribute before I steamroll us into the next slide? Interesting. We actually haven't talked about class yet, right? So what happens when you as a group are continually disenfranchised by the nation that you belong to and essentially assigned a class, right? Or are denied certain amounts of class mobility? That's really interesting. I will get to this in a slide later, but would anybody like to take a stab at that? How does class and culture intersect?
Class in terms of?
Economic class.
Economic class, okay.
What kind of class are you thinking about?
I was thinking, like, you go to India, you get different class of people.
Castes,
you know,
yeah.
Social class. Interesting.
So we look at Franz Boas's definition of culture and says it's a dynamic set of inherited social behaviors. And one of the factors that it is contingent on is actually class position, right? So not only racial category, which is a category that is imposed on us by the dominant culture, not only is it class-based, which is also something that is a system of social and economic organization that is determined by a dominant culture, but it's also, can anybody come up with an additional factor that might create a dynamic cultural identity? Okay, not only is it racial, and not only is it related to economic class, any other contributions that we would like to make?
Age.
Interesting. It might be age-based. Anything else?
Gender.
Gender, a really important one that we're also going to talk about. And one that we're not really going to talk about all that much, but your level of physical ability. And also, like, the communities and cultures that are built around that. For example, deaf culture is very vibrant and also has many subcommunities just inside the United States. So yes, all of these things create this dynamic set of inherited social behaviors that may actually vary within a culture. So we call those subcultures, like, you know, goths and gamers.
Yeah. How about the beauty? Some
you know, people actually talk about pretty privilege a lot.
Yes.
And I don't have a coherent analysis of this because I don't think about it that much. But I think there is something to be said about the way that we see physical, not only unattractiveness, but deformity, and how we've assigned value to people based on that, right? So if we see somebody with like an amputated limb or like a chromosomal deformity that is visible, then we automatically judge those people based on certain cultural values that we have that are very related to beauty and ability and, you know, our quote unquote personal preferences that are actually very, very culturally ingrained, right? So yeah, there are a lot of factors that we will be discussing in the second half of this seminar. Let's see how much time we have left. Not that much. Okay. I'm going to bypass this individual activity. Oh no!
The banana activity.
Oh my goodness. Well, this is something that you may want to do by yourself. Basically, I would give you a minute to write down every label that you think applies to you. And we would cross-reference this later with this idea of dominant narratives and counter-narratives. So what labels do we identify with because we've been told to identify with them, rather than ones that we have come up with ourselves or ones that have been, you know, quote-unquote God-given, right? Okay, so that is something that you may want to think about later. Remember the banana. Okay. 1 second. Do I have an outlet nearby that I can plug into? Yeah, my computer is dying.
Sure, whatever is plugged into this guy.
Ahaha! Okay. Thank you, tech support. Yep. Thanks, Dad.
Is it long enough?
Yes.
No. Barely.
Yes. I'll just come over here. Thank you. Let's see if it's charging. Yes, it's charging. Hooray. Okay. Now I have to scroll all the way back to the banana. Okay. So here is a case study that I would like to, hey, why isn't it doing the thing? Ah. I see. It's because PowerPoint is a nonsensical program. Okay. So here is a case study that I'd like to present and how culture and all of these different factors that we just discussed can drive people to change their cultural values. So let's look at this from the perspective of a Chinese immigrant who comes to the United States somewhere between 1840 to 1940, right? So that is basically a century of Chinese existence in the United States. Most of these early immigrants were men. They were coming over for economic reasons or for schooling, but mostly for economic reasons, aka they wanted to go to Gold Mountain during the gold rush of 1849 and bring back untold riches to their kind of middle-class villages back in southern China. So a lot of them were also Cantonese speakers. A lot of them came from four specific provinces in the south of China. And when they came to the U.S., they faced a lot of racial persecution. They were targets of persistent legal and physical persecution. So not only the Page Act of 1873, which bans female Chinese immigration to the United States until 1943, not only is it the Exclusion Act of 1882, which bans all Chinese immigration to the United States, or the Asiatic Barred Zone Act of 1924, which actually prohibits everyone except Filipinos from immigrating to the United States, or the California Alien Land Laws, which prevent Chinese in California, the majority of whom reside in California, from owning land. they're also subject to this period of driving out where Chinese communities would just be evicted wholesale by, like, white people who were, let's say, dissatisfied with the wages they were getting and blamed their deteriorating workplace conditions on the Chinese instead of their bosses. So this results in some of the largest mass lynchings in American history. So that, and also they were harassed by police constantly for suspected illegal activity, which was often a pretext to deport Chinese men en masse. So these are people that we consider the first illegal immigrants, because a lot of them came over after the Exclusion Act in kind of in, through loopholes in either semi-legal or illegal ways. So they circumnavigated these laws that were excluding Chinese from the basis of, or these laws that excluded the Chinese form the basis for a lot of immigration law that we see today. So because of these experiences of racial persecution, Chinese in America find it really, really hard to adapt to local culture. In fact, the only kind of lifeline they have to American culture that will accept them in any way is actually from white Christian advocates and missions that are essentially targeting the Chinese for kind of cultural reform, right? So it creates their willingness to adopt Christianity inside of a Confucian framework. Actually, a lot of these early Chinese who adopt Christianity are like, no, actually, you know, this doesn't clash with my cultural beliefs at all, because, you know, we're supposed to all follow kind of like this one social order that is predetermined in order to, you know, have a well-organized and, you know, obedient society. And so a lot of these values that Christian missionaries were teaching them aligned a lot with Confucian values. And they also had this desire to preserve their own cultural practices and ties to their home country. But because China was undergoing such massive political change at the turn of the 20th century, so they funded the Xinghai Revolution, which ended the Qing Dynasty and ushered in the era of republicanism, and also actually created the space for communist cultural reforms. So this means the creation of simplified Chinese, the creation of pinyin, the adoption of more informal ways of writing rather than just wenyan, and also kind of like these ideas of like destroying cultural traditions of the past. Yeah, it was a real mixed bag, to say the least. But one of those things was also increased gender equality. So a lot of these men actually are opposed to women's liberation in Chinese America because clinging to the Confucian values actually gives them a sense of power, right? So they are going back to their cultural identities and trying to preserve these traditional cultural values in order to give themselves a sense of power, right? Because they're not allowed to adopt any of the practices in the country that they have immigrated to. And the country in which they are trying to exert political influence is actually changing much faster than the community that is overseas, right? So they want to adhere to Confucian values. They try to send cremains back to China for burial, and they try to impose their ideologies on Chinese politics through remittances and donations. And they also try to control their communities and families by restricting what they can and cannot do, especially in terms of gender role and marriages, right? So a lot of these Chinese men are saying, I don't want to marry a Chinese American woman. If she's born here, she's too independent. She wants to go out and dance. She wants to talk politics. Not in my house. I want a nice girl from China who will obey me and have kids and cook dinner and blah, blah, blah. So on the one hand, you can really sympathize with these immigrants because they are really disempowered in almost every single way. But also the way in which they cling to their cultural identities and try to transform it is, let's say, not the most egalitarian way of going about things, right? So they're also kind of conscious of the way that they are perceived in American society and in the West in general, right? So Yuan Shikai, this cool revolutionary dude is actually like in 1915, like, I am actually going to establish the next Chinese dynasty. And everybody in the US is actually like, wait, no, we don't want that. Because if the West sees that China is going back to a monarchy, they're actually going to oppress us harder because we don't have good culture, right? So this idea that civilization and culture are collapsed. We don't have a culture that can sustain republicanism. We are inherently kind of inferior and subjugated, and we need a strong leader to lead us, right? And who better to do that than the West? So they are conscious that these racist ideas of culture are being forced upon them. So in response, they're like, okay, we have to maintain our own cultural identity. So here we kind of see two sides of the same coin, right? So in order to preserve cultural identity, in order to fight back against racism, we want to hold on to traditional values. And maybe that's something that we actually want, right? Like, it's not necessarily good to just throw away all the traditions of the past. Like, we love our festivals. We love respecting our elders. But at the same time, there are other cultural values that maybe we want to dispose of. For example, I mean, I'm sure you can think of all your examples in your own heads, and I won't say anything for fear of maybe inflaming the audience, but I'm sure you can think of some by yourself. So cultural identity can be restrictive and freeing, right? Which I'm sure you discussed in your groups. And it also responds dynamically to our environments. These men who were not allowed to move outside of their particular merchant class, who were pathologized as disease carriers, actually, and were kind of subjugated racially, economically, and exploited for their cheap labor, responded in a logical way to their disenfranchisement and exploitation by clinging to their cultural identities. But that also expressed itself in a way that was not egalitarian within their own communities. Okay, so now I want to talk about cultural identity and this idea of the master narrative. So these ideas of narratives within our communities that form our cultural identities. So a dominant narrative or a master narrative is who we are told that we are, whether it's true or not. So this narrative of American society. So for example, in American society, one of the dominant narratives is children should grow up and move away from their parents so they can live independently. And women should get married in their 20s and have kids by the time they reach their 30s. Does that sound like a dominant narrative that you've heard before? Ladies? So the consequences of living under this dominant narrative, you know, some people may want to grow up and move away from their parents. Some women may want to be married in their 20s and have children by the time they reach their 30s. These dominant narratives by themselves are not necessarily damaging, but the consequences of deviating from these narratives are what we should be concerned about. So this dominant narrative devalues family structures and social patterns of minority groups, many of whom often live with and support their parents throughout their lives, right? And it also devalues women's roles in the workplace and in society when we reduce them to kind of these homemaking roles. Not to say that they are not allowed to occupy these homemaking roles, but to limit them to homemaking roles is a consequence of living under this master narrative. This also applies to our community narratives as well. So tell me if you've heard this one before. If I get good grades and go to a good college for STEM so I can get a good engineering job, I can take care of my parents when they get old. Have we heard this before, young folks? But the flip side of this is hearing, if I don't get good grades, or I don't go to a good college for STEM, or I don't get that good engineering job, then I can't take care of my parents when they get old and I'm a bad Asian, right? I'm sure we've all said this out loud before, like, about anything from like, oh, I don't really like red bean, to like, I failed a class in college, like, I'm a bad Asian. But like, that is the thing that I'm getting at, right? We are living in a culture that sets certain cultural values for us. And we are able to identify when our behaviors do conform and don't conform to those cultural expectations. So cultural identity when we look at these dominant narratives and how they are shaped by them, it determines what we feel free to do and how we think about what we do. And they also determine the support structures that are available to us when we conform to them versus not. Because, you know, you've got a great community when you have that good engineering job, right? And you have, like, money. But if, for example, you go to Boston and decide to get a PhD in history, and Boston's really white, and oh man, I don't know if there's that much support for the work that I do where in the place that I am, where am I going to turn to for community support, right? And even then, like, people who drop out of college, people who have non-standard, like, life experiences, who maybe don't follow this specific trajectory, not only is it just, like, not a cool thing to kind of degrade these alternative life experiences, it's also an interaction with the dominant narrative that we expect people to conform to, either consciously or subconsciously, right? And this actually manifests itself most visibly in terms of stereotypes. So I'm sure you could complete the following two sentences with a variety of things, both, you know, positive and highly unflattering. Asian men are blah, blah, blah. Asian women are blah, blah, blah. Asian students are XYZ. So here I want to emphasize that stereotypes aren't benign. They have a purpose. So in the mid-1800s, and also, weirdly enough, in the 2020s, it seems like stereotypes never really go away. The Chinese living in America are so unclean. They eat weird stuff and they spread disease. Therefore, we don't want them in our society, right? In the 1940s, we see this emergence of this idea that Chinese American women are intellectually inferior to men. Actually, that part of the idea didn't emerge in the 1940s. It was always there. So therefore, they should not participate in politics. So this actually becomes an issue when national Chinese politics in America, like all of these different associations, start holding national meetings. And women want to participate. They have been in secretarial positions for these organizations for a very long time. But they're not allowed to speak or hold leadership roles until the 1940s, when this kind of women's lib movement starts to take off. 2020s, Asian American students, let me hear you. Asian American students are high achieving, therefore we don't need affirmative action anymore. So all of these stereotypes, oh, I included the last one just for you folks who are not ABCs. There's a lot of prejudiced attitudes held within Chinese American communities towards mainland Chinese, especially recent immigrants, like, they are too flashy, they don't know how to behave in society, they don't know how to be quiet and wait their turn, they're too rowdy, they're too entitled, they're rich, blah, blah, blah. You see a lot of this conflict, or at least I saw a lot of this conflict specifically in LA, where there are a lot of new rich immigrants coming in who don't necessarily conform to even Chinese American society, as tenuous as we may think it is. Did anybody hear about this case back in 2019? So this professor at UMD was like, all right, Chinese American students in my class, I know you're all cheaters, you can't do that anymore. If you cheat in an American class, you're going to get deported and your visa is going to be revoked. What's the dominant narrative here? Chinese students cheat. Yes, exactly. Chinese students, and by extension, Chinese people are dishonest, right? This is a very, very old stereotype. And, you know, we kind of joke about it by saying, oh, Chinese people are cheap. We're bargain hunters. We love our Costco memberships and our, like, 50% off BOGO, whatever. But, like, in an external sense, this is translated into dishonesty. Like, Chinese people will try to rip you off. Chinese people are always looking for a bargain, and they don't want to give you the full price of, like, what your work is worth. And this also translates into prejudice against Chinese mainland students who are immigrating today, right? So just an example of how these stereotypes are driven by master narratives that were set into motion in literally the 19th century. Okay, so I'm going to look at the slides for a moment and see if we have enough time to go through perhaps one or two questions. Okay. I think we're going to take the last couple of minutes that we have to discuss Christian identity and the master narrative. So how do our cultural identities as Christians, as Asian Americans, respond to these master narratives that tell us what the right thing is to do or who we ought to be, right? So here's another quote from Paul. You can read it on your own time. But in your small groups, I'd like you to discuss questions 2 and 3. Is this passage advocating for us to abandon our cultural identities in order to live missionally? Kind of a leading question. Why or why not? But then compare this passage to 1 Corinthians 9:19-23, which is one of the ones we read earlier. Do they contradict each other in terms of how we should approach missional living in a multicultural society? And in a broader sense, how should we approach missional living in a multicultural society, right? How should we respond to dominant narratives and master narratives? How should we respond to the idea that our cultural identity can be constricting as well as freeing? How do we navigate these complex relationships? So kind of a freestyle discussion. You can use these questions as inspiration, but generally this is going to be kind of a wrap-up kind of deal. So exchange ideas with each other, and then we'll come back together in a couple of minutes to discuss what we found.
Small group?
Small group. Oh, okay. Small group. Hello. Get back into your groups now.
Can you go back?
Thank you.
Okay, worship team, I better hear this conversation on stage. Gosh, aren't you so glad that those loud kids are gone?
Smart kids. Okay, it's basically 5:45 now, so I'm going to bring us back into the large group and ask you what your answers were.
All right. So what were our answers? Do we have any, you know, kind of sketches of ways that we might use our cultural identities in missional living?
Can we get a review of the verse and its meaning?
5:16.
Verse, the verse that was there already.
Ah, okay. So from now on, we regard no one from a worldly point of view. Though we were once regarded Christ this way, we do so no longer. Therefore, if anyone wasn't in Christ, the new creation has come. The old has gone, the new is here. So is this passage advocating for us to abandon our cultural identities in order to live missionally? Why or why not?
Well, for one, a different translation mm-hmm. uses different wording.
Ooh, I love it when people bring up different translations.
Well, I had a hard time understanding what that was saying. Mm-hmm. So I had to look it up, and the ESV says, from now on, therefore, we regard no one according to the flesh. We use that word instead of the word of point of view, and that kind of helped me because that's what I'm more familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's saying exactly the opposite of what you're saying. I think it's saying we should be embracing.
I remember when I was a kid, these missionaries, Mormon missionaries, came to our house, and my mom decided to go to the church, and she was actually baptized in a Mormon church. And you certainly see that they bring their culture with them in terms of how they dress and how, you know, it's like, well, is that what it's talking about, or is that, I'm not sure. I mean, is bringing your culture onto the mission field a good thing or bad thing, or it can be just a neutral thing?
I would add that it has also been used negatively to assimilate different cultures. So I think intention is very important and very important in like whether you intend to erase or you intend to embrace. I remember a while back reading about Hudson Taylor going to China and being a missionary, and he started out wearing Western clothing and all that, and in order for him to be able to really identify with people, which really is part of that definition of being a, what is that word, missionary? Yeah, the living type of evangelism, that he changed, and he started wearing Chinese clothing and all of that. And I feel, for me, that's what God is saying. Not that we should be adapting to every culture, but we should respect, as long as it's not against the standards and the words of God.
What a theologically sound answer. Thank you. Okay, so I think we're going to wrap up there. There were a couple of other slides. Maybe you can take these questions home to think about yourself. But really what I wanted to introduce today was some new information on how identity formation happens and what the consequences of that can be, and therefore how we might start to think about using it on the missions field. So I hope that was useful to you. I would like to, I suppose, dismiss you because we are over time, but thank you for attending this session. I really appreciate all of you for showing enthusiasm in your discussion, and I hope that you walked away with something new today.
Thank you.
What? Oh, the clip. Cord.